This is the cartooning edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us. The New Yorker's satirical and topical cartoons have a long and coveted history. Their unmistakable style of skewering modern-day social mores has been honed in the years since the magazine began including them almost a century ago. Since then, they have become a go-to feature of The New Yorker and part of American culture, hanging on refrigerators and in office cubicles all over the country. Cartoonist Bob Mankoff took on the task of deciding which single-panel funnies were good enough to make the cut when he became the cartoon editor for The New Yorker back in 1998. He joined us on Radio Times last year when his memoir, How About Never? Is Never Good Enough for You? A Life in Cartoons, was published. Let's take a listen to a portion of that discussion. This is a great cartoon. This businessman is on the phone. He's got his calendar open, and he starts, no, Thursday's out. How about never? Is never good for you? That phrase has lived on. Why do you think?
I think it lives on because, we're a species in constant conflict with the things we want and the things we must do. And what that I think I did that in 1993, and now it's in the Yale Book of
it's
Quotations,
everywhere.
Right?
Yes.
Right next to Mao Zedong and other famous humorists. And, it does what humor does. It's sort of a mashup. The mashup is that the message is rude, but the language is polite. And that's why the little tag end that you need at the end. You don't stop it in no Thursday's out. How about never? You could stop it there. It would
right.
still be a joke. You
right.
say it's never good for you. So it's even though you're being incredibly rude, you're still being right as though you care.
You have very interesting and very distinctive style. The some have called it pointillist style,
yeah.
but and that's I think that describes it pretty
that's
well.
Right. Dots, 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 dots.
How did you get into dots?
At the music and art, I looked at these photographs and I saw if you look closely at photographs, they're all made of dots. And I used to create faces from the dots. And there was something fascinating to me because there was a randomness as I did it. See that? Hear that sound? That would
yeah.
be the sound in my pen. That's
yeah.
how fast it would be going as I made the dots and the faces would form. And it was really a way of me sketching, a little bit of me covering up my awkwardness as a draftsman. I could draw, but and then the style just formed, and that's what I tell cartoonists coming in. Style is a process. Style is something that you partly control, but then controls you. And for me also, because the process would take so long, it would put me into this sort of dream state. Mm-hmm. And I think you need to be in a sort of trance state to come up with humor. You can't really, your logical mind, if you're just thinking, like a mind for the SAT is the worst mind for humor. Somehow it's got to be a little dreamy, a little loose, a little messy. So doing something else sort of frees up your unconscious to come up with ideas. I sort of call it dreaming while you're awake.
Yeah, and is it multitasking? Is it having radio on? Is it in terms of just sort of occupying your mind to get into that dream state?
I think actually you get into the dream state when you shut off all the stimulation after you've been stimulated.
Right.
And
right.
so that your mind starts to create these connections while you're actually being stimulated by ideas, while you're driving in traffic, while you're anxious about coming down on Amtrak, while these things, you're not thinking of jokes. All these though are going into your mind just in the way that dreams call them up again. So you're in a sort of you constantly move sort of between what I call soft focus. Slightly looking away from I looked away from the microphone, which is wrong.
You could hear that, right?
Yeah, slightly looking away from it, and then as you get a little kernel of an idea or a joke, so you say, travel. I just recently did a joke, where I said, travel. What am I concerned about travel? Okay, I'm concerned about the Wi-Fi internet.
Oh,
okay,
good.
So then I imagine, you're in Tuscany, or you've come back from Tuscany. And the people ask you how you were, and say, the food was delicious, and the cell reception was great, and the Wi-Fi was to die for. So you sort of mash all those up. But
no, that's great.
But they won't actually come usually when you're in in Tuscany.
You include some drawings of James Thurber, and I have to say, as a kid growing up, and I was sort of the opposite of living in New York. I lived in Delaware in the
right.
countryside yeah. in the 1950s and 60s, and I just loved his maybe because he used animals, his humor, his cartoons. You describe someone at the New Yorker describing him as a third-rate artist, but obviously he has been an inspiration for you.
Well, no, actually, that I'll just say Howard Ross was the first editor. Someone said Thurber was a fifth-rate artist, right. and he said, no, third-rate.
Third-rate artist.
And another anecdote along those lines is that Thurber had what I call, and he opened up a whole field for good and ill called good-bad drawing. He couldn't really draw very well. Right. But somehow everything he drew was loose and fine yeah. and had an iconography. Well, one day he knew his limitations as an artist, and E.B. White was his friend. Actually, E.B. White inked in his original drawings and sent them to, because Thurber just threw them away. So then after Thurber got published, he started to practice his drawing. E.B. White came to him and said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I want to get better." And E.B. White said, "Don't get any better. If you got any better, you'd be mediocre."
Which is brilliant.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. So his drawing inspired me originally because it was so loose, and I actually couldn't, in a technical sense, could draw better than him. So I figured, okay, let me develop my own style. And also, his humor was so loopy. Actually, if you look at his humor, you know, the knock against some New Yorker cartoons, and really most of them aren't like this, is I don't get it. Well, honestly, a lot of Thurber cartoons, if you look back, if people should, I'm talking about now, and they don't know it's Thurber. They'd say, "Really? There's a seal on the headboard, and yeah, the woman is saying, 'Having your own way, you heard a seal bark.'" That's become a classic.
Yes.
But it's not really a bada bing joke. It isn't. And in fact, the drawing is accidental. He actually was trying to draw that seal.
I'm looking at it right now, yeah.
He was actually trying to draw that seal on an ice floe. And then the ice floe looked like a headboard. Eventually, he drew the headboard, and then he did the rest of the cartoon. So everything about his stuff was a little bit spontaneous, extemporaneous, and loopy.
Did I read this right, that in, I guess, the early days of The New Yorker for the cartoons, that one person did the pictures and another person did the captions?
For some, not for Thurber, okay. Not for some, but there were. Gag writers then. Jim Garrity, who was the first art editor, cartoon editor, did most of the captions for Peter Arno. George Price really didn't do any of his ideas. So sometimes it was a combined effort, as I talk about in the book. Over time, that changed when sort of the idea, mainly in the 60s, came out of authenticity. So more and more singers sang their own songs, right? Now, you know, they might do a cover, but almost every singer now is also a singer-songwriter.
True.
And so the cartoonist, William Shawn, I don't think necessarily intentionally, but part of who he was the great editor after Howell Ross wanted it to be one thing.
Yeah. And how many submissions did you have before your cartoon was accepted in 1977?
I say 2,000, but it's lots.
Really?
It's lots. Just it's lots. Lots, because I was submitting every week. You know, people say, "Oh, I have an idea for a cartoon." You know,
yeah.
When
heard that before, right?
I've heard that before when I was at my cardiologist one of my visits, of course. You know, and he found out I was cartoon editor of the New Yorker. He stopped all his machines and said, "You know, I have an idea for a cartoon."
Yeah.
I said, "Great, I got an idea for a bypass." but the people think that they have. We don't get one idea. So when I would often submit 20 or 30 ideas at
wow.
a time, and I was doing everybody else's cartoons, so it took me a while to actually find my particular voice.
Well, and it's hard to describe what got in. Perhaps you've probably done this before. Yeah. The one that got accepted. I mean, it's
a
great
cartoon. It's a very strange cartoon, but I was very influenced by Saul Steinberg. And so it's a very detailed drawing of an old-fashioned printing press. And with the guy is at the end of the printing press, but it's at his breakfast table. As the whole newspaper comes off, he's reading the paper, and he has a little glass of orange juice and eggs. So I was sort of surprised by it. And my early cartoons were strictly visual.
Yeah.
You know, the next one, there was one where there was a cartoon, a guy opens a medicine cabinet, and all you see is apples. So, you know,
the apple a day, right?
A woman carrying water, but instead of two buckets, there's three, and so it's H, H, and O. So they were very, very cerebral cartoons. And they were very much influenced by European cartooning, by Saul Steinberg. And those cartoons are actually very – I don't do that anymore. Those are like real dream cartoons.
Well, you also have used your various marriages as part of your cartoons.
Yeah.
One is a couple sitting together having dinner, and the guy is saying to her, look, I can't promise I'll change, but I can promise I'll pretend to change.
You have no idea what a huge effort that is for men.
Then there's another one on the next page, two guys talking to each other. They're at an intersection. Women want more these days, Bill. It's not enough to be just a jerk anymore.
That's really those are slow realizations over the course of three marriages that I came. That really, actually, you know, I mean, you probably remember, Garfield, you know, often it was really enough to be a jerk.
I do remember some people in my life like
right.
that. Another one that I like, and it's two guys in a car getting out of a parking spot, and this one guy is saying, amazing. Three failed marriages, scores of disastrous relationships, many financial reversals, and countless physical ailments. But through it all, I've always had good luck parking.
And that's directly from from my own experience when I was going through a really bad time in the 80s, and all of those things were actually true.
Including the parking space?
But that was like the thing, the silver lining, good parking luck.
You look at about, 500 submissions?
Well, it's about 500 from our regular cartoonists. You know, wow. And about 500, and we look at them eventually, they come in from around the world, from really everybody, amateurs, professionals, nephews, nieces, who are extremely talented, of course.
Of course they are.
And from those 500, I take about 17 is what gets, on the average, is what gets in the magazine. I'll take 40 or 50 of those to David Remnick. We meet with Sylvia Killingsworth, the managing editor. So it's me, David, and Sylvia. There are three baskets. No, maybe, and yes.
Wow.
We tried four baskets. It drove us mad.
That was my interview with cartoon editor for The New Yorker, Bob Mankoff, from 2014. We're devoting this hour of Radio Times in Review to the art of cartooning upon the release of the new documentary, Very Semi-Serious, a partially thorough portrait of New Yorker cartoonists. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We continue our hour on cartooning by revisiting my interview with popular New Yorker cartoon contributor Roz Chast. Her rough drawing style and personal subject matter have made her cartoons among the most distinctive and recognizable of the New Yorker cartoons. She joined me last year to discuss her life in cartooning, her family, and her graphic memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It went on to win a Kirkus Book Award and a National Book Critics Circle Award. Let's take a listen. I was reading your book over the weekend, and I have to say, my parents, very different from your parents, but at the same time, there was so much that I related to in this book, because I think we are all completely unprepared for when our parents begin that decline into their death.
Yeah, that's true. I certainly was.
The idea that just I mean, they were clear in denial, but how difficult it is to face up to the fact that at some point you're going to lose them.
Yeah, well, I think there's so many aspects of it that are difficult to talk about that we all want to avoid. I mean, I think one of the things that I wrote about in my book was that it wasn't just like I was the sane person trying to get them to talk about death, and they wouldn't. It's more like we were all complicit in this avoidance, and it did not make things easier. And I don't really have a clear answer for this.
But it's interesting that they ended up coping with their lives in such a different way. I mean, your mother was, what, a force of nature?
Oh, she was...
Scary.
She was... I think they call them human dynamos,
or
forces of nature, which is, you know, these are like scary people to me. It's not a positive in my view. They're usually people that kind of, I guess they're good at getting things done, which is if you want, they're good in a crisis. They are good leaders. My mother certainly was that. She was very smart. But very inflexible and kind of scary.
Well, you're more like your dad.
I'm more like my dad.
So. Who was a worrier, for one thing.
Yes. My mother.
Like of everything, it
of
seems.
Of everything. I mean, he just could, I refer to him in here as a chain worrier. He just went from, once he solved one worry, he went to another worry. He'd have, you know, like a chain smoker. And I am exactly the same way, unfortunately. I wish I weren't, but, you know, I can see whether it's nature or nurture, you know, I solve one worry and then I have to go on to the next one. And it's very annoying.
Well, in fact, you have a wheel of doom in this book. All the things to be afraid of, including... flower pot falling out of the window.
They knew somebody. They knew somebody who was killed by a falling flower pot. If a terrible thing hadn't happened to them, then they knew somebody that it had happened to. I mean, my mother, when I was growing up, I had heard the story of her having had diphtheria many a time. Most kids did not even know what diphtheria was. I mean, you knew you had to get the PTD shot or whatever, but you didn't know what diphtheria was. I knew what diphtheria was from the time I was like 7 or 8. My mother told me I had a web which grew across my throat. And she always spoke in this kind of, you know, she didn't want to have a Brooklyn accent. So she had this sort of almost like 1930s, like movie star kind of things. And she said, and my mother wrapped a clean rag around her finger and she stuck her finger down my throat and ripped the web out. And you know, when you're a kid, you hear the story, you think, like, oh, my God, I hope tonight I don't get diphtheria.
You're right, where my mother's sticking her hand down my throat. Right?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I don't want a web to grow across my throat. That's disgusting.
You also have a section later on in the book about your father's mother, who objected, I think, to your parents' marriage. But she also slept across the bottom of his bed until he got married.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Just as a protective measure?
Oh, or? I don't know. Oh, who knows about that? It was different times.
Were you a good student?
Yeah.
You just rolled your eyes at me.
Yeah, I did not
like it.
You had
to be?
I had to be. I hated it. I mean, occasionally I had a teacher that I loved and somebody who would sort of like break through the fog. But mostly, it was very hard for me to pay attention. I was so, you know, I mean, I probably would have been diagnosed with one thing or another.
Like ADD or something.
Or, you know, attention. I definitely had serious attention deficit. But I don't know if I would call it a disorder. I just didn't want to pay attention because it was boring. And I wanted to be an artist. But my parents were my mother was an assistant principal. My father was a French and Spanish teacher. School was a very big deal for them.
Yeah.
And so it was like there were no options. I had to do well in school.
Did you have teachers, though, that saw your artistic
abilities? I did
have,
yes. I had a couple of art teachers in high school who were really great, really encouraging, and who helped a lot.
Yeah. I mean, that can mean a lot to a kid.
It meant an enormous amount. If you feel like you want to be an artist and adult says, you know, I think maybe you should be an artist. That's like a big plus.
Well, you went to college at age 16, right?
Yes.
That's pretty young. Did you skip some grades?
I was born at the end of the year, at the end of November. So I started kindergarten when I was 4. And then in junior high, when I was in school, I don't know if they still have it, they had something called an SP program. I don't even know what that stands for, but if you, they tested you in sixth grade, and if you were above a certain, I forget whether you had to be like 2 years ahead or 3 years ahead in math and in English, then you had this option of either taking seventh and eighth grade in 1 year and then going on to ninth grade, or taking enriched classes for seventh, eighth, and ninth grade. Wow. And my parents, in their infinite wisdom, despite the fact that this meant that I would be 12 when I started ninth grade, they had me take seventh and eighth grade in 1 year. I think that their thinking was that junior high was such a sort of cesspool that they wanted to get me through it as fast as possible. So it wasn't complete randomness. It was that they really thought, with some correctness, that it, junior high was a sort of horrible place to
be. Best to get it over with as quickly
as
possible.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I was also a very babyish 16, so it wasn't so great.
This, and you went to RISD, right?
Well, I started out at a school called Kirkland because they let me take all art classes, and then I transferred to RISD because I really did want to go to art school. My parents were not so thrilled about the idea of my going right from high school to art school, but that's really what I wanted to do.
There was a period in your life, as you write in this book, I guess from the 90s or maybe even late 80s and into the early aughts, I guess, I think that's what it's called, where you really didn't see your parents. I mean, it sounds like you were raising your own family.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you had to, if not divorce yourself from them, you had to separate from them in order to create your own family?
It wasn't that conscious, and it wasn't that I didn't see them. I didn't see them in their own, you know, native habitat. I moved up from Brooklyn to Connecticut, and they would come up and visit me. And I was busy. Mm-hmm. The idea of going to Brooklyn to visit them, I just made every excuse for myself to not make the effort to go see them in Brooklyn, and they would come up and visit me. And part of this was I had two little kids, and there were probably other reasons. It was hard to think about, like, I don't drive from Connecticut to New York. I didn't learn to drive till I was, you know, so I would have to sort of like Shanghai my husband into, you know, loading up the two kids in the car and driving, you know, from Connecticut into Brooklyn. And it just seemed like, ugh, this is the last thing I want to do after dealing with, you know, two kids during the week. Like, now on the weekend, we're going to, you know, drag them into Brooklyn. And the kids didn't want to do it either. They had plans for their weekends, and they had, you know, sports and whatever activities. And it was just very easy for me to sort of stick my head in the sand and ignore the fact that my parents were getting older and maybe I should visit them, that this was actually an effort for them.
Well, and also, I would assume for you going back to your childhood apartment, I mean, it sounds like an apartment that didn't have a lot of good memories or happy memories anyway.
No, this is true. I had no nostalgia for that time of my life. None. I had no nostalgia for Brooklyn. I had no nostalgia for that apartment. I did not particularly want to go back there. So, yeah, there were definitely some other reasons of avoidance.
I think we can all relate to exactly what you're talking about. But you did go back. I mean, finally, you decided, I need to see sort of where they live and what it looks like.
Well, it was a very strange thing because it was really easy to remember the date where it just like hit me. And it was kind of like this just very intense need to see them in Brooklyn. And it was a Sunday. It was September 9th, 2001. Hmm. 2 days before the World Trade Centers were hit. So that's why it was so easy to remember when. And I just had this need, really, to see how they were doing, where they were living. And it was kind of surprising.
Yeah. I mean, it was
dirty. It was grimy. And I realized I was going to have to get a little more involved in their lives.
Was it shocking to see sort of what their life looked like?
It was surprising. Shocking would be a few more notches on the knob, but surprising. It was dirty. It was a little disorderly. I could see that things had changed, you know, and that they were really getting older. And I was able to see them in a way that was different from when they would come up and visit me for a couple of days in Connecticut with all my kids around. Also, it was just for the first time, it was just me and them. It wasn't like me and my husband and my kids and my house and, you know, it was just me on their turf and just with them.
And again, that's Roz Chast, our guest on Radio Times here on WHYY. And really the title from the book is trying to talk to them about what their life was about. And
talk to them about what their plans for the future were, because that's what I was starting to think about. I was starting to think, boy, at some point, I don't think they're going to be able to live in this apartment forever. And what happens then? I mean, unless they both die at the same time in their sleep, and the odds of that seem very unlikely, something's going to have to change. And I didn't know what would happen. I mean, I remember thinking around that time, are they going to come up? And, you know, I would look at places in Connecticut, like near me, these little, not really assisted living, but sort of small, like a little condo. And I thought, well, maybe I could buy them like a little condo near me. You know, I would just, that's what was starting, to percolate sort of like. But I was thinking, I didn't know whether they were thinking about the future at all, but I was starting to think about it. Maybe they weren't. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like when you moved your parents into the place finally and you had to go through their apartment and go through all their stuff, and you include some extraordinary photographs in here that you took of what their apartment looked like. And it was, just filled with stuff.
Yeah.
And as a child who has gone through my parents' belongings, I mean, and you always wonder, did they have a secret life? Is there something about them that I didn't know that I might discover after they have died? Did you have similar questions?
Totally.
Something I just did not know about them?
Yes. I totally relate to that. When I was going through their stuff, I did hope for that. But I think it was pretty soon after that I realized if they did have this secret life, they had kept it very,
very secret.
Very secret. The biggest discovery that I made was this box of letters.
Yeah.
It was letters that they had written each other during World War II. And it was on the top of this closet in this like falling apart corrugated cardboard carton. And actually there were a couple of boxes because it wasn't just that. There were other letters that they had written each other when they were, my mother used to call it, courting. And my father wrote my mother not every day in World War II, but sometimes two or three times a day. It is just astonishing. There were so many letters. At some point, I mean, I started trying to put them in order, and I think some of them were in order, some of them were not. I couldn't even read them all. First of all, his handwriting was kind of hard to read, but there were like hundreds of them.
Which they saved,
which my mother never told me about. And so to me, this was the biggest find for me and the closest thing to a private life. But I wish I could say that the letters were more risque, but they weren't. That was great. That was a great find.
To be honest with you, what I appreciate about the honesty of your writing is you don't sugarcoat your relationship with your mother. You certainly don't sugarcoat her dying days and the kinds of feelings that you were left with as her daughter. I mean, there are these horrible cliches about closure and people saying things on their deathbed that, sort of heal all wounds.
Yes.
And it's...
Doesn't always happen.
No. I think it rarely, probably, if ever, happens.
Yeah. Well, I did feel, oddly enough, and this was not something I expected, I did feel closure with my father. And if you had asked me before, like a week before, I would have said no. But it happened, and I felt that. I felt like we were okay and that it was all right. But I don't know, more complicated with my mother.
Yeah. How do you think about her now?
I have a lot of mixed feelings. I, admire her in many, many ways. I feel like she really did the best she could. I have a lot of compassion for her. And sometimes I feel bad because I have a daughter who I feel very close to. And I feel like she missed something. She missed that opportunity. And so in that way, I feel sorry for her.
Do you think they would recognize themselves in your book, your parents?
I think they would. They might be upset. I don't know. It's not a book I would have written when they were alive. Right. And it's also a book, I think, that would have been much harder to write if I'd had siblings, because people don't like it sometimes when you try to be true to what you felt. I mean, it was a lot of mixed feelings, and I tried to articulate all those different feelings, all the different strands, and how they combined or didn't combine. It's not a mommy dearest sort of book.
Not at all.
I've been asked, like, did you feel like catharsis from this book? And it's like, no, not really. I really just wanted to write an honest book about what it was like for me to go through this process. It was also very funny, in part. My parents were kind of batty. Maybe they didn't see themselves as batty, but sometimes I saw them as, you know, they would have these bats arguments, and I would have these conversations with them. Like, I remember my mother telling me about how the apartment was sort of chilly, and they were wearing these, like, bathrobes that I had sent them, like, from Land's End or someplace, and sweaters, and it was, like, you know, 58 degrees, and they also had this, like, space heater on from my childhood in the 50s. And it was like this ancient, ancient thing. I had seen it. It looked like a rocket ship. I mean, it just had exposed coils. It looked like disaster waiting to happen. Plus, I don't even know the wiring. It just looked really frightening. So I sent them a little ceramic heater that I thought was much safer. And my mother told me that it had, like, the third safety prong, but the building is so old that she said, I'll just, like, file off that third prong. And I thought, no, 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 please don't do that.
No.
You know, just wear the bathrobes. Use that old heater from the – do not file off that third prong. So, you know, I had – there were many funny – sort of harrowing but hilarious aspects as well. You know, this is not a grim, totally grim book.
That was my 2014 conversation with award-winning New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast. We're delving into the world of cartooning and cartoonists in this hour of Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about Al Hirschfeld, whose singular style often graced the pages of The New Yorker. Stay with us. Welcome back to the cartooning edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We now round out the hour on cartooning by listening to my conversation with local archivist and cultural historian David Leopold. He joined me earlier this year to discuss his illustrated history of the life and work of caricaturist Al Hirschfeld, who spent most of the 20th century drawing definitive cartoons of American icons. His work was featured in the pages of The New York Times, Rolling Stone, TV Guide, and yes, The New Yorker. David Leopold's book, The Hirschfeld Century, is filled with Hirschfeld's illustrations and a thorough examination of the late cartoonist's artistic progression. Let's take a listen. We know him now for his use of that line. You know, that's
sure.
A very energetic line, but you see his early stuff, and it is kind of traditional. Some of it looks like pointillist. Some of looks like, you know, what you might see at that time at the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, he was doing all this work to support, to pay the room rent, as he said, because he really wanted to be an easel painter. He had started off wanting to be a sculptor, and he discovered a sculpture was just a drawing you could trip over in the dark. And he wanted to be a painter and had a fairly good amount of success. Had shows in, would eventually have shows in New York, Paris, Chicago, St. Louis. He was doing all right, but it was this. He had been introduced to caricature, which was sort of the vogue at that time in the mid 1920s. And Hirschfeld was left holding the bag for a lot of bills. And he spent the next year and a half. This is 1924. He spent the next year and a half working for Warner Brothers, never going into an office. That's the one thing you have to understand about Al is he never went into an office. He always worked in his studio and would drop off the drawings, and he did them on his own time. And so he was working for Warner Brothers, but he would bring the drawings down. And at that time, where his studio was, he had met a he was 20 years old. He at a party at Carl Van Vechten's, he meets a 19-year-old artist who's just come from Mexico by the name of Miguel Covarrubias, and the two of them take a studio together. And it's Covarrubias who really turns him on to caricature.
Well, it's interesting because caricature can be a little nasty. I mean, it can have a kind of hard edge. You're sort of playing with people's in this way, sort of distorting or even exaggerating people's features. But his work is not malicious.
No,
it's not benign, but it's a sort of loving, friendly picture of somebody.
I always think of it as what your friend would do rather than what your enemy would do. We can make fun of it. When you're friends with somebody, you can say really the worst things,
right,
you know,
right.
And it's not so bad. But Al wasn't even like that. He didn't have the bile needed to be a mean person. I mean, if he had any deficiency, it was that. And the caricature that he grew up in was not a caricature of a put-down. It was really a form of modern art. It was the overloaded portrait. You know, it was trying to capture the personality and the character. You know, he was probably the 20th century's greatest caricaturist, maybe the greatest caricaturist of all time. But the fact is, he really didn't practice caricature as we traditionally define it. It isn't a put-down. He uses exaggeration, but not anatomical distortion. There's no big heads and little bodies. He thought things like that were as funny as looking at yourself on the back of a spoon. You know,
oh, the kind of distorted, slightly distorted look you get from that.
But there's no wit to that.
Right.
It may make you smile, but there's no wit to it. And he was looking more for that sort of epigrammatic portrait, you know, that sort of that like an Oscar Wilde epigram, you know, something that would make you think and would sort of outlast, you know, the lines that we know from Importance of Being Earnest live on despite the fact of whatever the play is. And that's what Al was trying to do. He was trying to create art that withstood its topical value, that would had more value to it. And it's only now that we're seeing how successful he was, because audiences today, younger audiences today, millennials, don't look at the work and say, oh, Katharine Hepburn, she was great in this, or Carol Channing, I love seeing her in this. They look at it like we look at Lautrec's work of Jane Avril. When he did those pieces in the late 19th century, I'm sure they were very accurate. I'm sure they captured the sense of what she was doing in the cabarets in Paris. But today, there's nobody alive who would have seen that. And so we look at it for aesthetically. It doesn't matter who it is or how accurate it is. It's a piece of art.
What's so interesting in watching the sort of evolution of this artist is how he was influenced by some time that he spent in Bali. And on the face of it, I thought, you know, what does Bali have to do with these line drawings that we so associated with Al Hirschfeld? How did that work for him?
Well, it's so unusual in the sense that by 1931, Al Hirschfeld found the Depression depressing. And he had read Mutiny on the Bounty and had decided to go to Tahiti to paint. And when he gets there, he is appalled at the culture that's there, because it seems like it's imported from central casting in Hollywood. The natives are playing Irving Berlin songs on ukuleles. You know, everyone is trying to do the Paul Gauguin experience. And he writes, his friend Covarrubias felt the same way, and he went to Bali. And so Hirschfeld writes to him as he's leaving Tahiti saying, this place is terrible. I've got to go someplace else. And Covarrubias writes him back. It reaches him in Australia. And he says, I found paradise on earth. It's so beautiful here. I'm going to go back to New York to get he wanted to make a book deal. He actually got a Guggenheim Fellowship to write what is still a primary text on Bali.
Wow.
And he said to Al, if you can get here, I'll leave everything for you. And Al trades a painting to a ship captain, and by way of Madagascar ends up in the village of Denpasar. And he said there that the sun was so bright that it bleached out all the color. And all he saw were black and white line drawings walking around. Huh. And he said that's where his love affair with line began. And he spent 10 months there. And while he painted, and we have a number of paintings in the book, it's the first time they've ever been published.
And they're beautiful.
Yeah,
I mean, they're lush and colorful and...
I mean, he made a very conscious choice in his life. He could have gone a very traditional path, but its line just starts taking over his interests. And he finds that the native culture of Bali totally encourages that. They don't have a word for artist in their language. They refer to him as the clever one. And he was fascinated by shadow puppets, you know, how expressive and how much character they could convey just in shadow and line. And when he comes back to New York, the bright spotlight of Broadway replaces the bright sunlight of Bali. And there's a drawing that we have in the book that only was recently discovered, actually. We had had a clipping of it, but the drawing showed up in the most, you know, unusual way in a back room someplace of George Jessel and Fanny Brice on stage at Brooklyn's Paramount Theater. And he has them arranged just like a shadow puppet show. And it's a direct connection to what he was doing.
Well, it's so interesting to look at his career, his long career. He said, I became aware of what I was doing when he was in his 30s. So it took him a while. And I think for any artist, those are wonderful words to hear, is that this stuff takes time to sort of find your tools and your vision.
Well, he believed that talent was a drug on the market, but that it was discipline that really made the great artists. And he worked all the time. He loved to draw. He couldn't stop himself really from drawing. So while in the 20s, while his friends were interested in what works went into museums and the smartest magazines, he was working for newspapers and movie studios, and his work was being seen by literally millions of people. By the time he was 25, he has an audience in the millions. And he only gets more popular for the next 75 years.
I'm assuming he was a well-known figure on Broadway, you know, going to either openings or going to plays or even rehearsals. Would he work in the dark? I mean, how would he do his drawings from real life?
Well, the way he worked was he liked to work from life. That was his preferred. And he would go to out-of-town tryouts because for most of the 20th century, for at least the first three quarters of the 20th century, a show did not open cold in New York. It would start in Philadelphia or Boston or New Haven, sometimes all three of those. And the shows, they would, once they put them in front of an audience, they would know what worked and what didn't. We saw it recently with Hamilton.
Sure.
In New York, Lin-Manuel Miranda decided that hearing the audience told him more about the play than anything else, and that's why he wanted to wait to open it on Broadway. So Hirschfeld would go to these. He learned to draw in his pocket because he knew that there wasn't a lot of light in the theater. He didn't want to distract audience members from what he was doing, and since he couldn't see it, he trained himself to do it. He thought it was like typing. You don't look at your fingers when you're typing. This was a very spontaneous, direct eye to hand to pad, and he would create sort of hieroglyphics that he would capture. He was looking for some gesture, some movement, some piece of costume that might reveal the character of the performer, the character the performer was creating. He used to say that his job really was taking the character created by the playwright, portrayed by the actor, and he would reinvent it for the reader. So he would take these sketches and then come back to New York. And in his studio, he would sometimes augment this with some photographs. He claimed he had a faulty memory, which was completely not true. And, yes, I'm calling Al Hirschfeld a liar.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
And he would collate these into his drawings. Wow. And there wasn't a formula. And in fact, he told me at one point that when he felt that he was doing something that felt like he had done it before, he would stop and start a new drawing. Because one of the great things about his career is he was ubiquitous. And one of the toughest things about his career is that he was ubiquitous. He couldn't keep doing the same drawing. He never fell out of favor. He didn't have – the traditional arc of an artist's career is it take a long time to figure out who they are. They have their peak moment, and then there's the inevitable decline. Hirschfeld doesn't have that. He discovers who he is relatively early in his career and just gets better at it and has an audience that is completely with him the entire time.
You include a quote. He says, and this is a chapter titled, "The Line Gets Big." "I'm still involved with the mystery of line and what it can do. I found no formula. It's difficult not to fall back on what you did before. All I know is to keep paring it down, eliminating until it's pure line that communicates." I mean, not only was he a wonderful drawer, he's also a wonderful writer, it seems, of what he is doing and of people. and himself.
He wrote several wonderful pieces. The best is probably this wonderful satirical book called "Show Business Is No Business." But he ended up giving up writing because he said in writing there were 150 ways you could put the line, and in drawing there was only one way. Uh-huh. And that's really what he was doing. He wasn't a minimalist. He wasn't trying to just pare it down for the sake of paring it down. He was like a poet who was trying to convey everything that needed to be said with no extraneous words. And for him, it was no extraneous lines. And that quote comes in the 1980s. So he's in his late 70s, early 80s, and he never stops pursuing what it is that he's doing. He never stops experimenting. At this time, he starts doing these drawings for the Friday Theater column in the Times. It's a teeny little space. And for a man who had commanded six columns out of the eight columns of the top of the fold of the New York Times for decades, to have this very small space should have been a real barrier to him. But instead, he keeps on getting better at what he does and is able to say more with less.
But it just shows what a great artist he was. I mean, the fact that he could use just a couple of lines or take a feature, and as she said, you knew exactly who it was, even if it didn't really look like them.
And that is the alchemy of art that we can't really put our finger on. I mean, what he did, we can see a part of a Hirschfeld drawing and know right away it's a Hirschfeld drawing. It's not – he didn't use any special pens. He didn't have a special technique, maybe working in a barber chair. But I don't think if you work in a barber chair, it's going to do anything different. It was very much who he was. It was his DNA that you're seeing there.
Well, there is a drawing in here, Death in Philadelphia. And one of the things that Al Hirschfeld says is describing, you know, this collaboration, we met for lunch at the old Lafayette Hotel Cafe that same day. I don't remember what I ate at that luncheon, but 15 years have passed since then, and the gas pains are still with me.
Oh, Al could be devastating and funny, you know, and about himself, a self-deprecating man, of course. And his friends, you know, a lot of his close friends were writers, and he had a real affinity. He was a very well-read guy. And in fact, as he got older, his biggest complaint was that nobody wanted to stay up as long as he did anymore.
You were a friend, as I was, of Tony Auth. Also, you
sure.
A curator of his work, curated the exhibition that was at the Michener. Tony was an artist in residence here at WHYY, Pulitzer Prize winning editorial cartoonist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, among his many accolades. And I have to say, looking through this book, I feel Tony's presence and energy and humor and passion.
Yes. Well, the great newspaper artists, you know, who were part of a daily conversation or a weekly conversation are, I think, a breed unto themselves. That fraternity has always been very, very small. And Tony and Al both represented different parts of it, right, but they liked each other's work. I mean, one of our touchstones when I first met Tony was Al's work, and he was as interested as anybody else. And in fact, I had started writing this book before Tony passed away. He read the first chapter. I had done it, and I said, "What do you think? Is this what you're looking for in an Al Hirschfeld book?" And it's just a shame. Oh, he loved it. And he couldn't wait to see the whole thing. And he was just so thrilled for me and excited that Knopf was doing this. And, you know, it's bittersweet in that regard because, you know, the love that Philadelphia has for Tony Auth is similar to what New York has for Al Hirschfeld. And again, nationally, they're both national artists who worked in a very, you know, in a regional setting, but had a national effect. And I think they're equals in many ways, although Tony would never see it that way because he had such a great deal of respect for Al's work. But I know that Al would have seen Tony as a fellow traveler, as it were.
That was my interview with David Leopold, archivist and author, who joined me earlier this year to discuss the work of cartoonist Al Hirschfeld. And that does it for the cartooning edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edited this show with the help of our intern, Diana Allen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.